Okay, this is our, we're recording now. This is Michelle DeMeo. I'm here with David Caruso, and I'm being joined by Charles Cochran and his wife, Monica Cochran. It is still June 3rd. This is our second session after a short break. So Dave, do you want to kick us off on where we'll pick up now?
Well, I think Charlie mentioned that he had some more stuff to say about those early years at Scripps. Because we do also want to understand how the institution developed over time. I think you mentioned that you were on one floor, your colleagues were on different floors, Salk was on the fifth floor. But we do want to know, since Scripps was in its foundation, how did it grow, how did it change over time? So whatever you think we need to know to sort of also hear that story.
Well, there were the five of us who were there to get it started. each of us had grants that we had applied for and gotten for the work we were doing. And since they were different, all the grants were different as well. And the important thing about the grants was that it meant that we would do that research and nobody could tell us what to do. And if we didn't do very good research, we wouldn't get the grants reapplied, we would lose our salaries and we'd be out of the building. On the other hand, if our research was going well, and we were getting into new areas, and we were getting more grants, our lab would grow bigger, and we would grow bigger, and therefore the whole institution grew bigger. And that happened. Also, we got brought in postdoctoral fellows who did very well, and I'm one of them, and several others who would get them then put on our staff as assistant professors at Scripps. And then they would become unique and do their work. And that's the whole place started expanding like that over the years. And you got to realize we were, those that we would bring in as postdoctoral fellows, we looked at very carefully. And then over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, we could see that they were really good at their ability to do research projects and think of new things to do. So then they would become independent and would get a lab of their own. Of course, we were also bringing in people from other universities who were doing work that was unique and that we would like to include in the work we were doing. And there were several people like this who were just really superb, like Hans Müller-Eberhard, who we brought in from the East Coast, from Philadelphia, from New York, and several others that did unique work that would benefit us all.
Could you talk a little bit about that? What were some of the strengths of the research taking place at the Scripps Institute at this time? Is this work focusing on oxidant injury of cells? What other materials were you working on?
Well, I can tell you some about what we were working on in my lab, but not what the others were doing. They were doing unique work, and I'd have to scramble my brain to remember some of them.
Okay, yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about your research then.
We were working on immunology and also the inflammation that goes with immunology and what there was that was causing the inflammation and then what was being done to repair our cells from getting inflammatory injury going even farther.
And what did you learn about that? What are some of the mechanisms that are taking place to repair?
Okay, well now this is getting into a whole bunch of stuff, all right.
Yeah.
the I made some notes. I also sent you details on this. But in terms of inflammation and inflammatory injury, it started out using antigens and producing antibodies to those antigens, and then testing out how they would work to produce the inflammatory damage in the skin, or glomerulonephritis in the kidneys, and arteritis. And the first thing found that with the antigen antibody complex, it would bind complement components. And this is where we had I got the help from one of the people who came in named Hans Müller Eberhard, because his sole area was studying complement, the various components of complement.
Where was he before he joined you?
He joined our group.
But did you say he was already working on this before he came to Scripps?
Oh yes, he was in New York.
In New York.
And he was very good at studying complement and determining what the complement components were. So we realized how we could use his information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the work we were doing in my lab needed it more than anybody else. So when the antigen and the antibody would come together, they would bind the complement components. And the important one that at least one of the important ones that we looked at was the third component, or C3, and leukocyte. The polymorphonuclear leukocytes, or neutrophils, would bind to that complement component in the vessels and in the glomeruli. And they would then remove the complement components, because they would break it down. And then one of the components, the fifth component, would be broken down by what our proteases were doing, and produce C5A. And C5A is a fragment of the fifth component, and that would attract leukocytes. And we could determine that by having a chamber with an upper and a lower level, and separated by a membrane that had tiny holes that leukocytes could go through. And we'd put leukocytes in the upper chamber, and then we'd put various things to stimulate them in the lower chamber, and that's where we found that C5A really stimulated the movement of the neutrophils from the upper to the lower chamber, and therefore in the body, they would C5A would be something that would be attracting the PMNs. And with C5 there, and with the complement components there, first of all, the neutrophils would bind to the C3, but then C5A would stimulate them to release the enzymes. And the enzymes that were really important were elastase, because the elastase would break down the membranes that the complement, that the leukocytes were sticking to, like the basement membranes in the kidney or in the arteries. And in the kidney, when they would break down the basement membranes, it would allow the protein, plasma protein, to go right into the urine.
Mm.
And that's what causes the problems with people with nephritis. And then we found that if we used inhibitors for the elastase, we could prevent damage to the basement membranes and stop the plasma from flowing into the urine. So this is the kind of research you do as you mm-hmm. go on, and you find out the first thing, and then you say, wow, let's try to find an inhibitor. And we did. We had got good inhibitors to elastase, and that prevented the damage to the glomeruli. And this is all stuff that could be picked up and used for human disease.
Mm-hmm. What were you? Did you have animal studies at
all
this time?
All done in animals, yeah. And rabbits and mm-hmm. guinea pigs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we studied the mechanism of the deposition of the antigen antibody complexes in the glomeruli and in the arteries. And we found that the important thing to be involved were platelets, and that they would be stimulated to release particular drugs that would then get the leukocytes to stick. And the way that happened was that the immune complexes would stimulate basophils, which are circulating leukocytes, and they would release what's called a platelet-stimulating factor, and then that would react with the platelets to release vasoactive amines, would cause the sticking of the leukocyte. I'm sorry, I'm probably getting into this.
Well, I have a question, because just to back up a little bit, you mentioned how important it was for the plasma proteins to stop them from going into the urine, and that there was an immediate benefit to nephrology that you noticed. Could you talk a little bit about, as you were doing this, when did you start to realize, oh my gosh, this is really significant for these different fields or these different types of diseases? Could you talk a little bit about the where you noticed the impact of your work?
Well,
or the potential for it, maybe.
I must say, I spent very little time thinking about what it could do for the human disease.
Okay.
But I did realize that if we're dealing with glomeruli in a rabbit,
yeah,
they're probably the same for glomeruli in the human being. And that's why we kept working with the animals in vivo and doing in vitro work. So while I realized it could be very beneficial to humans and to human medicine, we didn't go into that.
When did human trials start? Much later? Or it was never done for this kind of research?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
I don't know. It was some of the others coming up, I'll be
okay.
able to answer
yeah.
that question.
I was also, before you begin again, I was curious to know what sort of technologies you were using in the lab at this period of time. You know, I'm familiar with more modern science and some of the laboratory equipment that people are using today, the expensive laboratory equipment. What were you using in your labs to perform the experiments, to analyze what you were gathering from your animal models? Were you using separation columns? Were you using mass spec devices? Like, what was the technology that you were using to do this analysis?
Well, a lot of it was separating proteins and other things on the columns. And we had many different kinds of columns that could be used for specific reasons. And we used ultracentrifuges also to get, like, if there were complexes of things, they would ultracentrifuge down. And then a lot of just straight chemistry, finding out what what kind of a molecule it was that we were dealing with.
And what about the data analysis? Were you doing those calculations by hand, or did you have access to mainframe computer systems at that point to run programs to help you sort the data?
Well, we did have early types of computers, but most of it was just finding out. We could detect changes by the chemicals that would interact with the split products of the original thing. So we could tell whether that original thing was being broken up or not. If it's being broken up and creating things that were important, we could then detect them chemically. And when we get these chemical works working and knowledgeable, we would be able to use them for new systems coming along. So we really had a background of a number of chemical ways of detecting changes that then we would use on all the new things that came along.
So I assume these were, you're publishing your findings as you're going in major journals. The NIH is continuing to fund this research as well, and you're, okay.
Oh, it was, NIH was certainly funding it all. And each new thing, new area would give us a new thing for the next application. Because the applications would go for, I think, 4 years, and then we'd have to renew them. And we'd, so we'd, with the second series of 4 years, we'd have a whole bunch of new science that we had developed. And of course, each year we would be submitting that to the NIH as evidence of the science done during that year. So the next thing was the molecular structure of a different area of the leukocytes. And this is the kinin-forming system, bradykinin and the kinins. And we found that the reason we got into this was that in the absence of the polymorphonuclear leukocytes or neutrophils, we were still getting a small leakage of protein in the glomeruli when the antigen and antibody complexes stuck there. And so we wanted to find out what was causing that continued, albeit minor, leakage. And then we found that there was a group of 5 proteins that would come together and stimulate each other. One was clotting factor 12 or Hageman factor. Another was prekallikrein. Then clotting factor 11, and then high molecular weight kininogen, and they would react with each other, and would then release something that came from the prekallikrein, which is called bradykinin, and bradykinin is something that causes leakage of proteins from blood vessels. And that's what caused the increase in vascular permeability that we were seeing in the kidney, even though we had taken the leukocytes out. And then one thing about the business of the kallikrein and bradykinin and the development, the release of bradykinin, it causes inflammation and leakage of protein, is that this has been found in various types of human pulmonary diseases. Mm. And they found that because of the work that we had done in the animals. That's where animal studies help human beings. Mm-hmm. Then the fourth area that we worked in is the oxidative injury of tissues. And when the leukocytes are interacted with antigen and antibody complexes, they release oxidants. And the oxidants are inflammatory. And the oxidants then affect the proteins around, and then the changed proteins can affect the functions of cells. So this is another area that leukocytes do that's very important, is releasing oxidants. And then to study what the oxidants did, we developed specific inhibitors of the oxidants. And when we inhibited the oxidants that were released by the leukocytes, we found that decreased the injury of tissues, and this has continued into human beings in human studies, such as respiratory distress syndrome, where oxidants do damage the tissues, and these are oxidants that come from the leukocytes.
So what were the inhibitors that you created?
I wish I could tell you. I'd have to go back through the literature to find out.
Okay.
And number five, which is the final one, we began some studies with the surfactants in the lung, and surfactants form a monolayer in the alveoli and keep them from closing down from the elastic tissue around. So we got some surfactants, we got some surfactant material from infants who had died, and we get lavages from their alveoli. And I took that to analyze the protein that was present, and put it over a column, and which was an aqueous column, and found there's a precipitate of proteins at the top of the column, which I couldn't believe, because otherwise they should go down. And I did that several times. The thing has come back up. And I did it several times, and then I took that precipitate at the top and put it into organic solvents like alcoholic solvents, and it dissolved. So here it was, a hydrophobic protein that dissolved in non-aqueous substances, and I found the protein involved in that and called it surfactant protein B. And then the thing was that since I came from the lung, maybe it played a role in the problems that premature kids have when they haven't made surfactant. So I took the surfactant protein B, and which I can mix with the phospholipids, because the surfactant protein and phospholipids bond to each other. And this is the dipalmitoyl phosphatidylcholine, or DPPC, and the two together would then form a unit that would be this full-term surfactant. And so I analyzed the surfactant protein B and got an analysis of the entire amino acid sequence. And then I made peptides that contained portions of that sequence, and so I could analyze what there was in the total protein that was important in binding to the phospholipids and causing and forming calico, forming the bradic, the too many words, the surfactant. And so I got the peptides and found out that the ones that were active had positively charged amino acid and then some non-charged and then another positively charged in this combination. So then I made a simplified version of it, which was potassium and four leucines and potassium, 21 residues like that, which I call kale-4 surfactant. And that would mix then with the phospholipid. And the phospholipid has these rigid side chains that go out, and then it has the that are hydrophobic, and it has hydrophilic parts at the bottom, and they would interact with the lysines of the KL4, and the leucines would go up with the side chains of the dipolmethyl phosphatidylcholine and hold it in place. So that's how that would hold the surfactant. That's what made surfactant is what it is in terms of holding the alveoli open, mm-hmm. with a single monolayer around the inside of the alveolus.
Sorry, do you have a copy of the Science cover? Because that has exactly what
I do have a copy of it.
Do you know where it is?
Not here. The Science liked the article that we submitted to it so much they put it on the cover.
That's great.
It's a really cool drawing.
Do you know what year that was?
91.
I have one of the
copies. Yeah, where would that be?
I have it. It's in the books. My book.
Is like it in this. The book?
It's on the left side.
Let's
of
see if
that.
I can find
okay.
It. By your desk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Dave, did you want to jump in?
Nothing specific at the moment. I know that you're kind of summarizing the work over the 25 years, right? So starting in the early 60s to the late 80s. So it's good to know that. I'm sure we'll have questions, though, about what was happening on a more regular basis in the labs as this research is going on and who's involved and who's talking about it and stuff like that. But yeah, I'd like to hear what it is that you were progressing towards.
Well, we did that and finding out how for the first time in the world what keeps an alveolus open and how it does it. And that's these side chains of the phospholipid, and they're being held together by a protein, surfactant protein B or my KL4. And that holds it like that, so it can't.
So this is, I'm holding an illustration on the cover of Science from the 25th of October, 1991. This is illustrating what you're talking about right now. Is that correct?
And that's the article.
Okay. This is the SPB protein. This is an article from you and SD Revic. Is that how you pronounce it? Revic? Okay.
She's the technician.
She's your technician, okay. Who came up with this illustration? Is this your illustration?
You did.
I did, yeah.
And this was accepted as an illustration, as a model for what you were working on?
Yeah.
Yes.
They asked for this to put on the cover.
That's great.
And this is the KL4. These are the leucine, lysine, and this is the K, the potassium.
So sorry, for the audio listeners,
yeah,
the
so
orange
these,
part
these,
is the
hydrophobic,
okay.
And this is hydrophilic.
The yellow part's hydrophilic.
And these are hydrophilic head groups of the phospholipid.
You're pointing to the circles below.
Yeah, circles below, and then they have the side chains that go up, rigid side chains, and they're held together by the KL4 or by surfactant protein B.
Got it. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And so you can't squish that thing down because of those rigid side chains. Mm-hmm. So
why was this immediately picked up as being significant? This is the first time we've ever seen this.
It was ever known that it's what keeps the alveoli open,
mm-hmm.
and preterm infants. And these, they started putting the KL4 surfactant into a human being. First, we did it in rabbits,
mm-hmm.
and preterm rhesus monkeys, preterm rabbits, mm-hmm. and it worked in them
okay.
very well. And then we put it into some human beings.
Were they children? That there's babies? Did they allow that for the trials? Okay. Yeah.
That had not made it, so they were, when they're born, they turn blue and they have very, very little oxygen in their arteries.
Mm-hmm.
So it was learning how the monolayer of surfactant works and how it keeps these rigid side chains and how the surfactant protein B does that. And it became so important that they heard about it back east in Sweden, and they went and gave a Nobel lecture, Monica with me and I, and we gave a Nobel lecture to a whole bunch of those people, including Nobel laureates. And we had a dinner afterwards.
When this was in the 90s?
Yeah.
94
maybe?
Somewhere between 93 and 95.
So we got a free trip to Europe for that.
Who were some of the Nobel laureates that you spoke to while
you
were out
there?
I can tell
you two of them, because the story he's about to tell is that I called myself a Nobel sandwich. At dinner.
Yeah, at dinner, she was sitting between two Nobel laureates.
John Vane and Bengt Samuelson.
Bengt Samuelson.
You don't forget that.
No.
And I'd known Bengt Samuelson for quite a while, a delightful guy. Mm. And then he was put the head of the Nobel committee.
Right.
But to be there.
That shows the significance of this work.
Of the work, yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean, as I mentioned, it started going into human infants. And we, instead of using it as a whole bunch of them, about 1,200 it went into around the world, and they were doing very well.
So these are, this is some of your first human trials?
Yeah, I didn't do them. They were done by other people.
And, got it.
But they would get the surfactant had to be made by a company that could make it to be absolutely clean and so forth. We didn't do any of that sort of thing. So we got a company going near Philadelphia.
What company was that?
The first name of it was called the Science.
Well, first, very first name. This was the one in Doylestown.
Okay.
Acute Therapeutics was the very first name.
Yeah.
And then it went to Discovery Laboratories. And it's now yet something else.
Windtree.
Okay, so they're the ones, they're making the product and they're administering the trials?
And then they would send it out to the,
send it out
the various
to,
trials.
Yeah. And how involved are you in this process? You're just waiting for results to come back to you at this point?
Oh, yeah.
It was approved. It's FDA approved.
It's FDA approved at this point.
Years ago.
Okay. Were you involved in the FDA approval process?
No. But it was done by the company. And I remember one day I was standing right there and the phone rang. Monica handed it to me. And it was one of the guys at the company, a good, really guy, nice guy. And he said, "Charles, in 2 seconds you're going to be a very happy man. The FDA approved."
I can only imagine how exciting that must have felt.
You did, Charlie. You did go in the early years when it was J&J, because they had it first. You did go to the FDA meetings with them, and you also went to the EMEA in London with Discovery Labs, the English version of...
She knows me better than I do.
This is helpful. Yeah.
Helps to be the admin.
What did you have to do? So what was your role in that? You went and spoke about the...
Ask my admin.
I didn't get to go. I went on the trip, but I couldn't go to the FDA or the EMEA.
Okay.
They went off to the meeting, and then I heard about it afterwards.
Okay.
But there were regulations that the EMEA wanted the company, as I remember it, wanted the company to work on before they would have given
approval.
And then it came first from the FDA, from our FDA.
Okay.
And that EMEA meeting was in 2006.
I think we were already in
Europe.
It was either
five or six. Hmm?
We were in Europe already.
We were.
Yeah. So those were good times and mm-hmm. very enjoyable. I think especially that felt good about it being recognized in Sweden.
Absolutely.
About
yeah.
how the monolayer of surfactant works mm-hmm. to keep an alveolus open.
Right.
It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
So many babies are dying.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Dave? I'm not sure.
Well, it depends on where we want to go at this point in time. I also do want to hear, so you told us about the progression of your science. I'm also interested in knowing how your lab changed over the years in terms of its size, in terms of its productivity. I'm also curious to know about Scripps itself and how it changed over time. I think when you first started there, it was the Scripps Clinic and Research Foundation, then it becomes the Scripps Research Institute. So I'm also interested in knowing a bit more about those institutional changes and how that impacted, or if it impacted, the work that you were doing or the work that others were doing. And I'm also curious to know, I think you became an adjunct professor of pathology at the University of California, San Diego, starting in 68. So I'm wondering how that connection came into existence and what your responsibilities were. So, you know, I'd like to hear more about those years in addition to what you already mentioned about the science specifically. But again, I know now we're getting close to another hour passing, so that might be stuff to cover in the next session. It's kind of up to you.
We can do it right now. The expansion of the Research Institute and the separation from the clinic occurred after we had moved up away from the coast area of La Jolla up to the Torrey Pines area, and the expansion of the buildings occurred up there. We got new directors that replaced Frank Dixon, a guy named Richard Lerner, and he was very good at bringing companies in and people in to put money into it, and therefore we built new buildings and we could expand into a bunch of new areas that the Research Institute wanted to. And then it separated from the Scripps Clinic up there, and the boards of directors then became two instead of one. And as I said, we had a new Richard Lerner replacing Frank Dixon, and Richard was particularly good at building new buildings and bringing in new people. So that's the administrative side of it. In the labs, we would in each lab could keep expanding that lab as we did more and more research and getting more and more grants and more and more people, so that expanded that way. And I think that was the major way in which the Institute really expanded, besides bringing new people in. Then Richard Lerner finally stepped down, and we got a new director, Pete Schultz, who's there now, who you met, I think. Were you there at the meeting?
Yeah. No. I didn't. I know Grace met him, yeah, and he was, yes.
He's the guy who talks to you with a dog in his lap?
Yes, I heard. Yes.
That's how you know it's Pete Schultz.
So when did he take over then? That was...
around 10 years ago.
10 years. More than that, right?
Maybe more.
We retired 19 years ago, and he was already there. So it's probably 25.
Okay.
It's probably, yeah.
So do you remember him coming in and how that changed the work you were doing?
No, it didn't change our work. I came in after we left.
No, he came in way before because he was already there, but he wasn't. I'm not positive whether. Yeah, he. I cannot. It's funny what you forget. He was there before we left, but.
She's the one who knows all this stuff.
But I do not remember.
You were working at Scripps as well.
Yeah.
So can you tell?
He was my boss in the lab.
Yeah. When did you join, Monica?
I was there 27 years. So I joined in 78, January of 78.
And what was your job?
The administrative side of the lab, running Charlie's lab. The lab comprised at that point of about 50 people, but that was not only his big lab, it was several others as well. So he was my primary boss, but there were others whose work I then did. This was before the days. In fact, a lovely thing, ours was the lab with the very first word processors. It's Scripps Research.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit? So your...
We had a Wang. And there was nobody to ask because there weren't any other labs that had word processors. So I did everything on a typewriter.
Right.
No matter how many carbon copies, you know, that's what CC stands for.
Yep.
Carbon copies we actually needed. I always had carbon copies there. It was wild when you look back on it, on something like that. It was fun though. So we had a Wang word processor and then we grew up and went to other ones.
Right. Turned you around, Dave, so you could see Monica as well.
Hi.
Ask questions.
Sure. So I do want as the lab grew, how did it change, right? Did your responsibilities change? What were the interactions like? Because I can imagine when you're a small group, people that you knew quite well for a number of years, there's a lot of interaction that's going to happen. As institutions grow, those interactions might be more difficult to have, right? Within labs, among labs. So I'm also curious to know how the nature of, not the research itself, but maybe the research environment changed at Scripps over the years with its expansion, with its growth, if that makes sense.
Well, of course, the more labs there were and the more people brought in from the outside made it a added differences along the line. And it was hard to then keep track of what the various new scientists were doing, or even knowing them, because they'd be brought in without your knowledge. And Pete Schultz did a major difference, and that is from the science going on would be built therapeutics for human beings, because he came in from an organization called CALIBER, the California...
Something for research.
The biology. But in CALIBER, which was just in an institution right near ours, they made therapeutics and developed therapeutics for human beings, and it made the company very well to do. So they brought him in as Richard Lerner's replacement as the... director of Scripps Research Institute, and he has built many, added a lot of people, and are doing now a lot of work in clinical areas. And so it's a much different organization now than what it was when we were there. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I objected to it originally, but as long as they kept the basic science going, then I would approve it. Okay. The other thing about it is that the organization now has so many publications that come out that they were reviewed by the British journal Nature, and they brought in a series of, made a group that was judging various scientific institutions around the world, and you know the story. They found, they based upon the number of publications that coming from the organizations, and then the number of quotes of the science from other or other scientists, they judged Scripps to be number one in this country, mm-hmm. which made us all feel pretty good.
Sure.
Especially us, the kids, the five that, of course, they aren't alive now, but made me feel really proud to
Absolutely.
Have gotten this all going and now doing so much good with the therapies that are coming from the scientific work.
You'd also mentioned that in those early years, under the change in leadership, there was a move to bring in not just additional grants, but I think you mentioned the word investors, companies to provide funds to the research institute itself. Did I hear that correctly?
Richard Lerner, yeah, brought in, yes. And so did, I'm sure, did Peter Schultz. Companies that would, I can't be sure of this, and you probably shouldn't quote me on this, but the I think companies would be interested in helping develop therapeutics and therefore would put money into the science that goes into building them.
Well, that's how J&J became involved with your research.
With Richard Lerner.
No, yeah. It was Frank Dixon. I think there was a $20 million J&J agreement with Scripps Research that they had
right. I think that was Richard.
I think it was Frank. Right of first refusal. Mm. Okay, yeah, see they overlap, I'm not sure which. But it had to go through J&J, anything coming out of a lab that had any potential to be marketed mm-hmm. had to go through J&J first. And then they did the review of it. And that's how we got in with J&J. And it was 96 when you signed. That's when you started Discovery Labs, was 96. And that was instead of J&J, they had already given it back to you earlier that year. Mm. So that goes way back, Charlie, to like 95 or so when J&J decided to take it up.
So with that shift in the way that Scripps was working, did this, to this point it sounded like a traditional academic institution, right? You mentioned also you have people coming in, professors, and people going out, professors, and getting these academic appointments. Once there was this connection to these private companies, did anything change within the institution itself? I mean, now that you have some private companies wanting to opt into potential scientific discoveries, were they also requesting that the money be spent in specific areas over others? Right. Like, I'm just wondering, was it just, or were they just providing a pot of money that Scripps could use, and whatever came out of Scripps, there was the chance that, you know, like J&J, you mentioned.
You know, I can't answer that question. I've not been involved in this. This is a Pete Schultz type question.
Mm-hmm, sure, sure, yeah.
And also along those lines, as your lab grew, how did your role change within that lab? Were you still at the bench alongside everyone else? Once you had more people working with you, were you pulled more away from the bench and now just focused on getting grants? Were there changes for you as the lab grew?
Well, yeah, you can imagine with all the work going on, my hearing how they were doing, people would come in and say, I got to show you something. And so I would be in my office much more than I was early on, because I wasn't in the office at all. I was always in lab with a pipette in my hand. But that did happen. Still, I would work in the lab, like I was telling you about the surfactant protein B that I found in the column. That was my getting back at it. So I really did like to keep my head in the lab and work on things, but I couldn't do it nearly as much as I did before the lab grew up to 50 people.
Is that when you hired, when did you hire an administrator for your lab? Was that, or were you the first one?
Who
was,
admin?
Yeah.
No.
There
had been
from
others.
The start.
Yeah.
There okay. Had been and as it continued to grow.
Yeah, we had about how many? Four or three? What?
Well, I was maybe the third or fourth. I don't know how many going back.
Well, I know there were several because I had them doing work, and some of them just all they would do is type out a grant application or a paper that we were submitting for publication, and I would ask them to do something unique and they just wouldn't do it. So I found somebody who could do anything and unique things as well.
And that was Monica?
That was Monica.
Is your background in science?
No, not at all. That's what I was saying. I was an English major in college. Math and science are not my strong suit.
Sorry.
What she could do was to work out all the things that would be necessary to make everything come together and work in unison.
Here and are Richard Lerner's years, 1987 to 2012.
And then Peter
so
Schultz comes
Peter
in
Schultz
at 2012.
Peter Schultz then probably would have been 2012.
Okay.
So
we weren't there in 2012.
We were not, no. We left
okay.
in 2005.
Okay.
So it was Richard Lerner. There must have been a crossover because, let's see, then when 88, 89, this science article was 91. Yeah, it would have been Richard Lerner then, you're right, for... when we first went with J&J, which was in mid-90s.
Okay.
See, I'm a good admin.
You're good. Google.
She's the one who always knows the answers.
Or where to find it.
It was interesting.
And on a broader level, personally, what was going on? I mean, you started at Scripps, you were 30, I think. I know that you eventually get married. What was your life like outside of the lab during this period of time?
You know, one thing is my family, which is probably not significant, having children and that sort of thing. And having to leave one wife, the wife, and then eventually she says, you finally got it right.
Well, it'd be nice to hear, but I mean, must have put some strain on your relationships, perhaps, when you were working in the lab long hours, or how many children did you have? Were you involved in your children's lives?
Well, yeah. I got along with the children and vice versa immensely. That was really great. But then Monica brought everything into my life again. And as you know, we've been all over the world and like up going to Sweden, and she was the one who sat between two Nobel laureates. And I'm sure they really enjoyed her more than me. But I've become involved in a bunch of other things. One was I went on the board, I was asked to join the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art, which I did. And then I was asked to go into the ResMed Foundation, Respiratory Medicine and in the foundation, and I became head of philanthropy. And we put money into organizations that take kids from in San Diego County who are with very poor families, and help get them educated. So there, we would review maybe 30, 40 applications and decide which ones should receive the money. And these would then take kids after school who would walk, they're all over the county, and the kids would walk into their areas and learn science and other various things that they, that helped them with their schooling, and so their grades improved and their desires in life improved, and it gave them a new life. And that I have, day after tomorrow we have our annual meeting to decide which. We now had 46 applications coming in, and we have to, we only have so much money, which is $250,000 to give out to these organizations, and we have to make hard decisions. Some of them won't get the, won't get funded, and that's a sad thing. And we've now gotten into another area. It's when the kids, these kids from impoverished families get towards the end of high school, they have to decide what they're going to do, and some, without anything to do, they go into gangs and drugs and get incarcerated, and it's a very bad life for them. So we have started a new program which we call Career Development, and the kids can choose. They can go over a list of things like becoming nurses or carpenters or electricians or whatever, and they chose which areas they would like to get into. And once they do that, then we get them into a community college so they can be trained in those areas and then get a job. And the group that we're working with is the San Diego College of Continuing Education. We've had meetings with them, and we know the director of it, a guy named
Andre Lucas,
and just a marvelous guy, about 6'2", and he's African-American. So knowledgeable and so generous and so active. And he works out ways of getting them jobs in the, in nursing jobs at Scripps Clinic all over, because we've been meeting with him now several times. And we had a meeting where we brought all of these people who would like to do this work together. And it was on the 23rd.
About a week ago.
Yeah.
And had a marvelous meeting with them. And they will all be getting these, they all have kids in their groups that they will now be showing the areas of things that, the things they might like to do. And then they'll take them to the San Diego College of Community and Continuing Education and get them well trained.
And these are big organizations here in San Diego, the museums in Balboa Park that all have an outreach program.
Right, right.
So the total number of kids is about 25,000. And getting them, getting them a chance to have a good life that they will lead and they will do is good, makes you feel good.
Absolutely.
So those are the sorts of things we've become involved in. And we do it together.
Still working together.
You worked, because you, you began working together
January 78.
And then how long did you work together? And at some point you've become romantically involved and married.
Oh, like 15 years.
Oh, wow, a long time.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah. So you've always been, you know, working together in various ways, and now you're working together in retirement as well.
So it's 46 years.
46 years, yeah.
46 years.
Yeah.
After I finally got it right.
Right. Nice. Dave, I don't know if you want to scale back at all. One of the things we were talking about was some of, you know, your life outside of the lab and some other stuff. We didn't talk much about this yet, but you did have, you were an adjunct professor of pathology at UC San Diego, I think for quite a while.
Well, they had me giving lectures.
That's what I was wondering. So you did go lecture
immunology,
as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about that? You know, how many days a week were you lecturing? Did you enjoy lecturing? Did you teach labs too?
One lecture per year.
Oh, that's all. Okay, so it wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it would be a new group of young people that would come in the next year, so I'd give them a lecture.
I see. Did you build any relationships out of that? Did they come work in your lab at all, or
Chuck Parkos?
Yeah, we had one fellow who came over from came over to work in the lab.
Okay.
And you want to see a picture of him?
He's now. The head of
University of Michigan.
The head of one of the departments that Roger Wiggins, who had also been in the lab.
Okay.
He took over that chairmanship from an individual who had been in the lab, too.
Peter Ward is there,
Peter
too.
Ward.
Yeah.
Well, Roger Wiggins, too. Did he take over from... Yeah, he took over from Peter Ward.
Yeah.
Roger Wiggins was there, too.
These are postdocs who go out and become well-known and leading scientists and administrators, heads of departments. I was asked to become the chairman of about 30 departments around the country.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which I wouldn't do it, because if you become chairman of a department, you know how much you need to concentrate on the vacation time and the salaries that all the people in the administrative part of things need, and you never set foot in a lab.
Right. You also, you mentioned in passing earlier about, we were in Europe then. Could you tell me a bit, where did you go in Europe and how frequently, why? You've traveled the world as a few things. Could you talk a little bit about those experiences?
Well,
first of all, scientists are invited to give talks in beautiful places in the world.
Yeah, like in Poland.
Yeah, he was invited to give a talk in Poland, thankfully, in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also, I don't know if I was talking...
In London and...
Yeah, Switzerland, everywhere, Austria.
Yeah.
But did you spend time living abroad as well?
We did.
Could you tell me about that a little
but
bit?
This was after we stopped our research. And
it was after research.
The first couple of years, actually, were while we were still working. And then also, once we retired, the work did not stop. It just morphed into something else.
And this was Italy?
This was Italy, Florence, Italy. And we lived 3 months of the year in Florence for 10 years.
Did you have access to a lab while you were out there?
No.
So what kind of work did you do?
Before the days of the iPad, which made it even harder. But we rented a computer every year that we had in the apartment, and I knew it was the same computer because it had all of my same programs on it.
Where did you rent a computer from?
Through the people who we rented the apartment from. It was a wonderful relationship. They were, the apartments and the rental agency were owned by the Ferragamos.
Oh.
You may not know who that is, Dave.
Yeah, go tell us.
Ferragamo is one of the top designers in the world. They are headquartered, actually, in Florence. And so they owned like 60 or 70 apartments.
Designers of?
Shoes, but clothing as well. They have, you may know this, they have a wonderful museum on the top floor of this palazzo.
It's
the history of the Ferragamo shoes. But they owned the apartments as well as the rental agency, and we became very good friends.
Okay.
Not with the Ferragamos, unfortunately, but the people in the agency.
Okay.
It was great, and they did so much for us. Every year, we packed up all of our things. It was a fully furnished apartment, but if you see all the dishes that are in there, all Italian
whole bunch of
ceramics
from the Italian Renaissance. We have collected all these books that we were reading there, and they would take them down
into the cantina.
Yeah,
and then bring them back up when we'd come, before we would come.
And including my desk, my work desk.
Oh, wow.
And the well, the computer didn't stay when we weren't here, but the desk did. And that was wonderful because there wouldn't have been anything else in the apartment for me to do the work.
So, and at this time, you are able to work remotely then.
Yes, and it was before the days of iPhone, iPad. This would have made it so much easier.
Sure.
But for traveling, so we traveled while we were there, and I found I could just go to a little tiny internet cafe, which you've surely seen there. And it's very enterprising. A restaurant would have, or a bar, a cafe, one computer, one printer, but that's all you need.
Yeah.
And the kids that are studying there or traveling there all go to check their emails and do work. And it was great. It worked. We also happened to have had a computer, more than that, an internet cafe itself right across the street. So if I ever had a problem with the computer, I just went across. But if we were traveling, all it would need is one.
Right.
It's very clever.
But from all that, I got so interested in the Italian Renaissance that I put a book together on it. I have it in the other room.
So you've published on the Italian Renaissance? What did you publish?
It was self-publishing.
Yeah, what was that?
I can get it.
Well, while she's grabbing it, is this about the art of the Italian Renaissance?
About the art of the Italian. And why it was so important, because up till that point, everything was under the Catholic Church and the Pope. And the Pope said that everything can be in just two dimensions, one dimension, and they have to be religious forms. So there was a mother and child, or Jesus, or whatever. But then along came a guy named Giotto in 1310, and he did something different, which was slightly different. And then the people following Giotto did more and more of that.
Thank you. Significant Artistic Creativity in the Italian Renaissance by Charles G. Cochran. It's a self-published book that he did in 2015.
Did you show him, huh?
So when got into the Italian Renaissance? This is something you're doing on the side of science, or it's something you got into in retirement?
Sort of on, well, both.
Both.
Well, Rick, in 1952, his brother, when you went and spent 2 months with Rick in Florence.
That's when I first saw it, yeah.
This is your brother who went to Yale, did his bachelor's in history.
Right. Yeah, he was a Fulbright scholar.
And he went on a Fulbright scholar over there in Florence, working on an area that was very little known about it, which was post-Renaissance and pre-modern. And he wrote books on that. Got his PhD, and I went over to be with him in 1952 in the summer. I usually would go home, as we talked about, in Berkeley. But my parents said, why don't you go and be with your brother in 1952, and which I did. And he taught me all sorts of things about, like the language and words not to use. And can I give you one example?
Please do.
Charlie always used the plural for keys, which is chiave. Because if you say chiava, it means he fucks.
Does it? I didn't know
that. So I looked it up in the dictionary. and that's exactly what it is.
Okay.
I'm assuming you speak a fluent Italian.
A dialect. But yeah. Dave has some too.
Caruso.
Well, but not a Caruso.
Yeah. Did you learn that word too?
No, I mean, I haven't been exposed to that family for a long time, so it was when I was young, and it was just, you know, the angry conversations that would happen.
But you learned to say chiave?
Yeah, I heard it. Wasn't allowed to repeat it.
Yeah, he's not either.
So you have, did you, French and Italian then? Or some of the languages you spoke?
Well, not really. I tried Italian, but I must say that since it wasn't something we spoke constantly, the other thing I would do is I'd try to speak Italian, and I would plug French words in instead of Italian words.
Right.
The funny thing is that, I guess it's not funny, they all understood it because it's all based on the Latin.
Yeah. Well, Dave, do you want to jump in with anything else, or?
I don't think I have anything else.
Should we ask if there's anything that we didn't cover so far that you'd like to have covered in this? Anything that you're like, oh, geez, there was that story that I didn't get a chance to work into this conversation yet.
I think you've got a good coverage, and I was interviewed by the Research Institute, and went through all of these things. Did I send you this?
Yeah, you have that.
So you've seen all of this.
Yes, we're trying to cover some different ground today.
Yeah.
Dave, anything then that you thought of that we didn't cover?
No.
Okay, well, great. Guess we'll conclude by thanking you and Monica for your time with us today.
It was a pleasure. It's fun to think about your life.
I'm going to turn off the recorder now. Monica, we were just wrapping up. Was there any, before I turn this off, we were wrapping up and asking if there's any stories that we may have missed that you want to make sure you get into the record.
For the whole...
No. And we can always ask you again later if there's something as you're reviewing this, but just as we're turning it off, if there was something you're like, oh, geez.
I think you pretty much covered everything, didn't you? But as you say, if he thinks of something,
do it later.
I'll add it in the editing.
Okay.